Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 11 of NML Crossing. And boy, oh boy, that took me a lot of takes just to get the first line out. It's I'm even more marble-mouthed than usual this morning. It's not ideal when you're trying to, talk. Now we're starting the third week of this little project, and I wanted to give everyone a heads up as to what this week will hopefully offer, if I stay on track here. Today we're heading into Anthology Land with Batman Chronicles number 12. Then we got Nightwing number 20. Then Batman 554. Then we have a one-shot, Huntress, Spoiler, Blunt Trauma number 1. And then we'll be closing out with Detective Comics number 721. As I mentioned, this is the start of a new week, which means that we just had a weekend. And this weekend, for me, was, it was bat-heavy. It was very bat-heavy. I got a message on Twitter from, I didn't write down their name, I think it was Steve something. I need to, you'd figure I'd have that handy. I have all this other stuff, I don't have this one. I got a question, and it was a question that I kind of worried about getting as I was starting this up. And it was a question as to whether or not, or why not, Contagion and Legacy were included in this project, since those were, semi-fundamental building blocks that led to the, official or the proper No Man's Land crossover event. And so I thought about it, and I figured, well, maybe it would be nice to have some of that background flavor. I don't know what I want to do with it. I don't know what form this will take, if any at all. It might just be for my own lore enrichment that I can, share with everybody or refresh everybody on some of the, bigger beats of Contagion and Legacy. Anyway, I say all that to say I went on a little tour of the Phoenix metropolitan area looking for the Contagion and Legacy issues I was missing, because I've never read Legacy before. And I read Contagion from a turn-of-the-century DC trade, which is to say I read a very abridged version of the event. So I now have all the issues. Don't know what form any kind of analysis, if any at all, will occur, but I pretty much say that just to share that I was in the bins, because it's been a minute since I've enjoyed digging through bins, and this project has really been wonderful in that regard. It's making me want to search, and it's not just for, because comic fans, as we are, I think there's a measure of addiction there, right? When we buy stuff, I know when I started collecting comics, I didn't have much money. I was just a kid. I saved lunch money to buy, whatever I could every day, or every, twice a week or something like that. And now it's like, I'm like binging, I've been binging for years. I just buy stuff to buy it because I wanted it as a kid. And whether or not I'm going to read it is immaterial. It's just, I want it. I want it. I want to fill in these holes. I want these full runs. And it's nice to actually be hitting the bins again with full intentions of actually reading what I'm buying. And like a giddiness and like I can't wait to get home so I can, put these in the order they're supposed to be in, and we can start reading through them and we start taking notes. And I don't know, it's making me feel young in the hobby again, which is really, really cool. And, I've heard similar things from friends of the show who have, hopped back into their bins and are picking up what they're missing and just, picking up stuff that they want to read. And it's just so cool to hear that. I think we, comics collectors, myself especially, just get hung up on the collectability of not with any sort of intentions of selling or flipping, but just having and hoarding and wanting. But here, I'm digging through bins and I see something that I want to add to my collection so I can read it. And that's really cool. That's really cool, in my opinion. And I tell you what, if any of the words that have come out of this mouth have inspired you to jump into the bins, that really, you can't really put into words with that, how that feels, you know, because I know what joy that brings firsthand. So it's just a cool thing. It's just a cool thing. Now, with that out of the way, I'll head into my next pre-ramble here, which is about, well, the book we're covering today. It's Batman Chronicles, a quarterly anthology bat book, which, shockingly, I owned all the issues that I needed. I have never really paid attention to Batman Chronicles. I don't know how I think we have four Batman Chronicles we'll be covering as part of this program. We've got this one for Cataclysm, and then we have three deeper into No Man's Land proper. And I had all of them, which shocked me, because there was only one issue of Batman Chronicles I ever prioritized buying. And it was, boy, I can't remember the number. Was it 21, 24? Yeah, I should have wrote that down. I didn't. It was an anthology that featured the first and only, to that point, Brian Bendis story. Brian Bendis DC Comics story until, when was it? 2018? When he came in and, well, he Bendis'd all over everything. So Batman Chronicles number whatever the hell that was kind of a special book, and it was kind of a like a hot book for a minute when Bendis was starting to make his name in the indies and in Marvel, Sam and Twitch and Ultimate Spider-Man, stuff like that. This book was kind of a hot book because it flew under so many people's radars. I mean, I see the thing pretty often in 50-cent and dollar bins, so I feel like either it's just lost its value or people just don't know. But yeah, that was the only issue of Chronicles I ever like put on my, hey, you know, when you're in the bins, look for this list. And you know, I don't think I ever read it. I don't think I ever read the Bendis story in it. I might have. I don't think I did though. That's kind of the thing with anthologies, you know. They're kind of hit. Well, I can't say they're kind of hit or miss. They're just hit or miss. It's generally a mixed bag of, you know, I hate to say it because it sounds so dismissive, and I don't mean it to be dismissive, but it's just a lot of page filler, you know? And that's not an indictment on Batman Chronicles. That's just 90s comics anthologies, you know? I'm thinking about, you know, X-Men Unlimited, all the Unlimited titles, a lot of stuff. You know, that may or may not play ball with what's going on in the comics, that might be a repurposed something or another they found in a drawer somewhere. It might be another take on an old story. It's just stuff that, I don't know, that, I mean, to talk about something like, to use words like need as it pertains to comic books, it's kind of precious, but a lot of these anthologies are full of stuff we just don't need. And I mean, at their core, they are basically, in a lot of like these quarterlies, are just there to fill a fifth week. You know, comics shipments are on a, you know, fourth weekly schedule, right? You have 4 weeks in a month, but some months have that fifth week that is just kind of a skipped week, right? It's it breaks up people's routines of going to the comic shop every week because when they get there's nothing there for them. So we have these, you know, fifth week fillers, like Superman, Man of Tomorrow, this, the Unlimited books. Maybe it's just me having some sort of minuscule idea of how the sausage is made that kind of makes me biased against the anthologies. But with all that said, how about we check this one out? Take it for a ride. See how it putts along. This is, of course, Batman Chronicles number 12. Had a spring 1998 cover date. Remember, they are quarterly. Now, all of the stories here are edited by Vincenzo, easy for me to say, and Gorfinkel. And this one had a cover price of $2.95. We're going to take these story by story, go through the credits and all that good stuff. Now, our lead story, and probably the main event, is called The Contract, written by Devin Grayson with pencils by Marcos Martin. Inks Vince Giarano, colors Lee Lowridge, and letters Ken Lopez. Now, we open with this, and I'm going to say we open a lot today, I guess. So we open with a scene of Batman lifting literal tons of rubble in order to rescue a family who'd been trapped in the wreckage of the very bad thing that happened at 703. Now, this obviously isn't really happening. Batman's immortal, right? Amortal, not immortal. So he's not lifting tons here. This is really just a story that a young boy named Kirby is telling his fellow captives, including his mother and his grandfather. And again, Batman does not exist. Urban legend, all that jazz, we have established that. But this young boy, Kirby, not only believes Batman to be real, but he also believes he will eventually be their savior. And his mother and grandfather kind of humor him. Kirby worries that it's become daytime outside, because everybody knows that the sunlight saps the Batman's superpowers, and they'll have to wait until night, I guess. And I may as well set the scene here. We're in the bottom floor of an apartment building, which is sunken underground in the quake, and we've got us a bunch of survivors sitting around waiting for hopeful rescue. From here, we jump upstairs where we meet the heroes of the story. And our heroes are a random assortment of thugs, gangsters, and ne'er-do-wells. Now, they've been hired by someone to perform some search and rescue in the post-quake. And, you know, they don't like the gig, and they also don't trust each other. They don't like each other. But they signed a contract, and I guess a bad guy is only as good as their word, right? Now, we get a lot of arguing. They argue about everything and are very, very, very wordy. So they talk a lot. Now, they're arguing about whether to perform the search and rescue at all. They could just lie to their mysterious benefactor that there were no survivors here. They argue about the methods of the mission. Do they risk, do they smash their way in and risk harming some of the survivors? One of them says, we could say there were 10 survivors instead of 12, whatever. Or maybe they take it slow, steady, and safely to save as many people as possible. And things get heated. Guns are pulled, words are yelled. It's kind of a mess. Now, from here we get a refresher on what liquefaction is, and that's one for all my quicksand fans out there. And it's when, the ground turns to liquid after, or liquidish after a quake, and things sink into it. So that's why our bottom story of this apartment building is underground. Now, during this little refresher, lecture, whatever, one of the goons drops a lit cigarette. And, well, I guess there was a gas leak nearby because, kaboom. Underground, the survivors are able to hear the explosion above and they start shouting in order to maybe guide their would-be saviors to them. Now, Kirby starts cheering on Batman, who he's sure is leading the rescue crew. Then, some time passes. The explosion clears, there's no more sound coming from it, and we're back in silence. The survivors all, slump shoulder, sit down, the moment's passed. Upstairs, in the heat of that explosion, we've got rival gang members saving each other's lives, which we learn is part of that contract they signed as well. They gotta do their best to keep each other alive. Now, one of the head goons isn't keen on breaking any of the rules laid out in the contract, because, as he puts it, Gotham ain't the best place to break a promise. Well, one of the other mooks starts razzing him for believing in the Batman, because, again, we're post-Zero Hour and Batman is not real. We learn here that this assortment of gangsters was hired by some CEO. I'll give you three guesses. From here, we get a couple more heavily, heavily dialogued pages. Like, to the point where the font they're using is so small, you could probably fit each letter on a grain of rice, like they used to do at the mall kiosks back around the time this book was new. They're pretty much just reinforcing the current situation. There are people trapped below. They were hired to save them. Time to do the thing. Back downstairs, panic is beginning to set in. We find out they've been trapped around 10 hours at this point. Now, Kid Kirby's encouraged to rest, but he doesn't want to miss Batman's arrival. He and his grandfather have a pretty neat talk about one's ability to win against something they cannot fight. Like an earthquake. Grandpa tells him that in situations like this, you have to rely on your creativity more than your strength. Which, the fake-ass analyst portion of myself wonders if this is like a bit of like meta commentary from Ms. Grayson regarding this mega cross event. Because, you know, truly, the Bat Brain Trust can't have our hero punch and kick his way through an earthquake. They're written into this really, really strange corner, and they're going to have to rely solely on their creativity to get out of it. So I wonder if I'm just reading into things or if this is some commentary. Who knows? Back upstairs, and the rescue crew finds their way into an open elevator shaft. And they spend a couple more pages arguing about how to proceed. Two members of formerly rival gangs decide to head down together, and they consider the possibility, or probability, I guess, that everybody down there is already dead. One of the searchers is, he's keen to keep the faith, and so, after a very wordy, inspirational speech, down they go. Moments later, our crim crew pry bars their way out of the shaft and finds all of our survivors. Kid Kirby is, he's disappointed that his savior ain't wearing a cape nor cowl. Now, with the mission accomplished, the gangsters are dealing out the dough for a job well done. Kid Kirby runs up to one of them, the inspirational speaker from earlier, and he asks if they were sent by the Batman. This gangster tells him that, in fact, they were. He even hands over his share of the cash so Kirby can contribute all of it to the shelter they're going to be brought to. The other mooks, they see this and they can't believe their eyes. Turns out, this was also sorta kinda in that contract they signed. You see, they all agreed not to do anything that might crush the spirits of any of the survivors. And so, if Kirby wanted a bat savior, he was going to get one, by proxy. We close out with a look at the contract that our heroes signed, and we see that it's from the desk of, guess who? Bruce Wayne. Our next story is called House of Cards, with words and pencils from Chris Renaud, inks Bob McLeod, colors Ian Lachlan, and letters Clem Robbins. And it's a Ra's al Ghul story. I'm not a fan of Ra's. He always bored me to tears. That's my own bias here. I really can't judge the story for using him. He is a major character. Now, he spends pretty much the entirety of five pages mocking Batman about how his city betrayed him by, collapsing in an earthquake. He accuses Batman of being a madman, and he suggests that Gotham will never be rebuilt, and he hopes that since the city no longer needs Batman's protection, since the city no longer exists, the detective will surrender to the truth and take his rightful place serving at his side. Our next story is called A Bird with a Hand, with words and layouts by Rick Burchett? I don't know. Finishes Bill Sienkiewicz, I can say that word. Colors Grant Golish, letters Clem Robbins. This is another short one, very, very short. This one has a focus on the Penguin. Now we see him as he walks past survivors. He's going to walk past a trio of survivors trapped in the rubble. The first one, he walks past, and before agreeing to help him, he asks what he does for a living. And the man says that he's an accountant for a law firm. Now, since this is something that Cobblepot can use, or thinks he can use, he helps him out. He next walks past a grade school teacher who, he's got no use for a grade school teacher, so he leaves him to probably die. We close out this short piece with him walking past another survivor and asking what they do for a living. Pretty neat, pretty creative. We'll talk more, at the other end about each of these stories, but not bad, not bad. This next story is a pretty powerful one. It's called Trapped, written by Chris Renaud with art by Alex Maleev. Colors Jason Wright, letters Clem Robbins. And we open in complete darkness. There's a man, he's trapped in the rubble, he's upside down, really, really deep in the rubble. And save for his tiny penlight, it's complete black, complete darkness. Nearby, we see Robin. And he's using this, headset gimmick hooked up to a specialized mic in order to listen for any buried survivors. And as he's walking, he hears a voice calling out, begging for help. And this is all intermixed with our trapped man. Robin finds some nearby firefighters, and he asks them for some assistance in digging this survivor out. And after a bit of persuading, the exhausted first responders do agree to help. And the man, he hears some movement above him. He starts to get excited, and he starts shouting to help guide in the digging. above at the surface, Robin and the fellas do in fact proceed to dig. And they dig, and they dig, and finally, Robin finds who he was looking for, and he pulls a young child out of the rubble. The trapped man realizes that the digging stopped. And a few moments later, he doesn't hear anything at all. So, pretty heavy one. Pretty heavy one, that was a good one. Bit of a downer, but good. Next up, we got Love Me Two Times, with words and art by Klaus Janson, colors Noel Giddings, and letters Clem Robbins. And we open in a sinkhole, where we see the KO'd Two-Face laid out. Outside the hole, we have a trio of officers that are almost giddy with the opportunity put before them here. They can snatch Dent out of the hole and turn him in to collect the reward. Now, Two-Face isn't actually knocked out. You know, we can see his eyes are opening. We can tell that he's listening and he's aware of everything going on and everything being said. Now, two of the officers lower themselves into the pit using a rope they tied around a nearby lamppost. They lasso the other end of the rope and tie it around or wrap it around Two-Face's torso. That third officer pulls Dent out of the pit, but on the way up, that lamppost snaps. Now, Harvey is able to grab onto some sort of metal grating outside the hole, so very, very convenient, but I guess we'll allow it. And I guess this was like a spring-loaded lamppost because the third officer is like shot into the damn hole. So I guess how the turntables or how the tables or however you say that is what we got here. We got Harvey on the outside and the officers on the inside of this hole. The hole begins to fill with water for some reason. Maybe it was like a hybrid fire hydrant lamppost. I really don't know, but there's just water gushing into this hole. And the officers are freaking out, thinking they're going to drown, and they beg Harvey to help them out of the pit. And, well, we wrap up this story with Harvey flipping his coin and smiling when it comes up. Well, we could probably all assume what side it comes up, right? Our final story is called Little Orphan Andy, written by Kelly Puckett with art by Rick Burchett, however we say that. Colors, Noel Giddings, letters, Clem Robbins. This is a very, very short piece featuring Leslie Tompkins picking up a boy whose parents were killed during the quake. Not much more to it, but I suppose it does put Leslie onto our No Man's Land chessboard, right? Next episode, as mentioned, was Nightwing number 20, but I suppose we ought to talk about, well, the assortment of stories we just received. And we'll start with, we'll just take them in order. Devin Grayson's The Contract was definitely our feature story here, and it wasn't half bad. A little wordy, perhaps overwritten, but a good post-quake side story. Really good timing, too. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but just last episode, we had Batman, you know, mixing it up with the Penguin in order to get some more search and rescue crews out there. So that sort of informs this, and it's very convenient timing. I don't know if it was, like I said, I don't know if it was intentional or not. We get several more reminders of the Batman as urban legend timeline that we're currently living in. And I've already kind of opined on that. But, you know, I'll tell you this. Even though I knew this was a thing post-Zero Hour, I never expected them to lean so far into it. You know, it feels like a very inconvenient thing that you just, like, maybe just don't mention. You know, if you can get away with it. That's exactly what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a thing that was, but it would never get any kind of lip service. You know what I mean? Like, could you imagine current year writers being disrespectful of this sort of direction? I mean, there'd be contradictions and outright blatant ignorance of this wrinkle nowadays if the writer decided they didn't like the direction or simply couldn't fit their opus into the framework. And anyone who dare bring it up would be mocked for caring too much about comic books. Imagine that. So, you know, big respect to the Bat creatives of 1998 for playing the hand that they were dealt. Regardless of whether they liked it or not, or if it made them have to think a little bit more creatively to make their stories work. I mean, I'm sure not everybody was on board with it. It's a weird, weird thing. And I mean, I still think the Urban Legend deal is a bit wonky. Or, more than a bit wonky. It's just wonky. But we can see here, the Bat Brain Trust, they're committed, and they're making it work best they can. So I like that a lot. And yeah, I like this story. It was a good opener. A nice check-in on the people of post-quake Gotham. And probably the high point of the collection here today. Now, the Ra's al Ghul ditty was kind of just there. I already said it, and I've said it so many times over the years. I just can't work up any sort of interest for Ra's al Ghul. I find him beyond boring and horribly one-note. It's like every story with him that I've read anyway. I mean, I haven't read everyone, but they all feel very, very samey. And this was kind of just more of that. You know, he wants Batman to give up on his silly mission and join him. So, same as it ever was. Now, I did mention at the top of the show that I picked up the legacy issues I was missing, with, a half-assed eye toward putting something together with them. And that is a Ra's story. Which is probably why I never prioritized reading it before now. But, you know, I'm going to be open-minded. Who knows? Maybe that'll be the story that finally sells me on him. Because the little story we read here didn't. And I mean, that's no fault of the creative team. This just isn't something I get giddy about reading, regardless of who was bellying up to the typewriter and or artboard. A case of it is what it is, or it was what it was, I guess. Now, the couple-page Penguin story was pretty cool. I enjoyed it, but it's weird. I'm not sure if this will make sense to anybody but me. I have a very addled mind, clearly. But reading this kind of gave me flashbacks to the way comics were being written around the turn of the century. Like, there was a definite shift. You know, for those of us who were in, you know, the hobby back then, there was a pretty drastic shift from comics being, you know, very, very art-focused, with story being secondary or even tertiary, behind marketing and whatnot, to a time where story took precedence. And, you know, comics became like a writer's playground again. Or maybe for the first time ever, they were just very, very writer-focused, like across the board. Not just for, like, mature titles, but, you know, throughout all of superhero comics and all comics, basically. Like, this is when writers, to me, were kind of eschewing comics pacing and instead going for a more, like, pseudo-cinematic feel. And, you know, I'm thinking a lot about the aforementioned Bendis and his cohorts, where we would get, like, repetitive panels, repetitive dialogue, even though that does make sense in this story. Just the kind of pacing where you almost feel every panel in an almost real-time sort of way. Very, I don't know, very framey rather than panel-y, if that makes any sense. It was, at least to me, you know, the ripe old age of 18, 19, I found it novel, almost groundbreaking, like in its adaptation of the, I suppose, comics language when I first came across it. But, you know, things don't stay new and novel forever. So, like, when it got to the point where entire issues or entire arcs of Avengers featured the cast sitting around a table eating Chinese food and being witty, it kind of wore out its welcome. Or at least for the idiot who's spitting into this microphone, it did. Now, Trapped was a killer story. Even though it was kind of predictable. You know, you could kind of call this one it's not tropey or anything, but you can kind of tell where it was going. At least I was able to kind of suss it out, and I can't suss out anything. So even though it was kind of predictable, I think it played out very, very well. It's a bleak story. But there's also, like, this lining of hope around it, right? I mean, our feature character, the man who's trapped, probably is not long for the post-quake world. But Robin was able to, you know, rescue a child. Now, Alex Maleev, he's able to convey claustrophobia, panic, just pure desolation. But also, there's that brief reprieve in the middle where there's relief and hope, and our man thinks he's about to be rescued, and there's an excitement that, you know, it goes as soon as it comes. You know, it's very, very well done. So, I mean, even if none of the other stories we talked about today stand out to you, I think you ought to give this one a shot. It's really well told. It's well directed. It's really, really good. You know, it might actually be the highlight of the issue. It shines like a very inconvenient light on all sorts of superhero vigilante type stuff, where we get that reminder that even the heroes can't save everybody, and it's sobering to think about. And then you think about, this is just one person's account, right? This is just one guy who is buried in the rubble out of however many are buried in the rubble, all listening keenly to whatever might be going on above them, and hoping that their shouts can be heard by a passerby who might take pity on them and start digging. It's bleak. I think I said bleak already, but it is very, very bleak and very, very well done. The Two-Face story was, I mean, it was kind of contrived. I don't know. Everything about it was very convenient, to the point where it had a very manufactured feel about it. And I get that all fiction is manufactured, right? This one just kind of lets the stitches show. I get, it does put Harvey Dent on our No Man's Land chessboard, though. And one of the very few things I do remember from my abridged reading of No Man's Land 20-some-odd years ago is that he will play a pretty decent-sized role in later stories. So we got to get him here. And, well, now we know he is here. Finally, the Leslie two-pager. It establishes that she's here. And not all that much more. It's a fine enough way to kill a couple of pages to fill out an anthology. And I'd guess this one, due to its brevity, is probably included in many of the Cataclysm collected editions. I mean, can you fit in two pages? Probably. I could be wrong. But it's a reminder that not everybody made it. And not everybody's gonna make it. And it's cool that we get to see Leslie here, because in our opening, 10 or so chapters, there's been a lot of priority put on first responders, right? And obviously so. There was a massive disaster, so you need police, you need firefighters, you need doctors, you need EMTs, you need anybody who can help. But you also need some sort of social services help too. There are going to be young children here, Orphan Andy. He's probably 2-3 years old. They got to figure out what to do with him. And he's probably not the only one. So this shows that social services are going to be invaluable in this coming cross event, right? As, dealing with trauma, and loss, and grieving, and all those things that it's not always easy to put on display in an action-oriented comic book. It's easy to have, policemen with guns drawn or firefighters, blasting a hydrant at an inferno. But, someone sitting across the table from someone asking how they feel, it's not something we think about in this sort of a story. So I like that we're getting this very brief reminder that that's a necessity right now in post-quake Gotham. Overall, well, it's a 90s comics anthology. We kind of get exactly what we expect out of it. If you've read, the Marvel Unlimiteds back in the day, not the app, but the actual, paper, X-Men Unlimited, Fantastic Four Unlimited, it's kind of like that. It feels kind of like an annual, which are also generally mixed bags back in the day. Is it must read? Eh. Is it skippable? Probably. Do we get any value-added No Man's Land stuff? Kinda, right? If nothing else, it does give us a peek into how the non-Bat characters are handling the fallout of that very bad thing that happened at 7:03 p.m. It does enrich the lore, and it aids in building the No Man's Land world. But at the same time, I don't think I would recommend breaking your back or bank searching for it. If you find it cheap, if you have it in your long box already, yeah, give it a look. Pick it up, give it a look. But definitely don't break the bank. And I'm sure this is probably part of the Cataclysm collection on Hoopla. So if you have a library card, you can check this out for free. And I'm assuming it's probably on DC Universe Infinite. If that's... I think I got the name right there. DC Universe Infinite. I think it's probably on there as well. So give it a flip through if you have some time. But before we cut out of here, let's do a brief mailbag segment here. We got a couple of messages. I've actually had a lot of really, really great conversations over the past few days. The community aspect of this program is, it's just wonderful. It's really, really cool. It's hard to put into words how cool it is. But since we are going pretty long today, I'm going to just cover a couple of things that we've discussed here. I got a text from my buddy Dave regarding how we say Mark Bucking's name. And he says to me, Thanksgiving is for turkey, but on Christmas we have Buckingham. So, what say you? What say you? Is it Buckingham or Buckingham? We know we have a vote for ham, and I can go either way. It's funny. This is such a comic fan problem. You know, we've talked about this before. It's like you see these names in the credits, and it's like you never think about saying them out loud. They're just words you recognize as people's names, but when you say them out loud, it's like, huh? Same with some of our characters. It's like, is that a hard A or a soft A? I just don't know. So, what say you? Is it Buckingham or Buckingham? You all let me know. We'll see how that plays out. But thanks so much for the text and for listening, Dave. And we'll close out with an email from our friend Eric. This is regarding the Brotherhood of the Fist and reading orders. And he says, I've read Brotherhood of the Fist in the past, and while it does take place in Gotham after the quake, it happens before No Man's Land proper. This story and the other Robin, Nightwing, Azrael, and Catwoman issues take place between Cataclysm and No Man's Land, but they're not labeled Aftershock, so they're not included in the omnibuses. However, the background setting for these stories are in a quake-destroyed Gotham, it just hasn't yet been declared a No Man's Land. I guess it's up to interpretation whether they should be added to the series, because it's kind of like having an adventure with a red sky in the background. Keep in mind that this would also add another 30 to 40 more episodes to the series. And yeah, I just don't know. You know, if anybody's listened to anything that I've done, you'll know that I get, like, super obsessive about having things as complete as possible. Like in X-Lapsed, we literally covered issues where one X-Man showed up on one page of an issue somewhere. You know, we dedicated whole episodes to that just to have the most complete kind of look at this time capsule era, right? That said, that might be part of the reason why X-Lapsed kind of burnt out. So, I don't know, you know, I think we'll probably try taking it like case by case, issue by issue. If nothing else, I figure I could probably do a meanwhile segment, maybe one every few episodes where we capsulize what's going on in the other Bat books that aren't necessarily tie-ins. Maybe ones that do, I don't know, with a quake looms larger, we'll just include as full episodes. I don't know, my problem is I need everything to have rules, and this has no rules. So I'm kind of like a fish out of water. And I mean, that really was the hardest part of deciding to start this project. Like I said at the beginning of this episode, at the beginning of the first episode, it's like, where do you even start with No Man's Land? Do we go back to Cataclysm? Do we go back to Contagion? Do we do Legacy? Because they all kind of have, they're all kind of bricks in the No Man's Land wall. And it's difficult to try to parse down and to, I guess, distill into what's necessary. And I realize and I can appreciate that I'm putting way too much thought into something that really doesn't matter. But it's the Chris way. And if you've been listening, this is no surprise to anybody. But definitely good food for thought. And actually, Eric sent another missive with a correction. And it's about Robin 52 being in the omnibuses. Of course, Robin 52 was like part 4 of 4. And it was very much a red sky, right? Robin returns to Gotham for the last 3 or 4 pages, or he flies over Gotham in the last 3 or 4 pages, and we can see that the quake happened. And I had mentioned that that Eric had said the entirety of Robin 52 was in the omnibus. But looking back, I must have misread or misunderstood. It was only those four pages, just like in the current year trades or the most recent trade collections of Cataclysm, which, in my opinion, makes a whole lot more sense than including some weird martial arts drama in the middle of the fallout of the quake. So thank you so much for clarifying that for me, Eric, and of course for listening and for sharing your thoughts on our little bat triptych we're going to be putting together to get through this and navigate these no man's land waters. So thank you so much. But I think this is probably the longest episode yet, so I should probably put a cork in it. Now, if anybody out there would like to share their thoughts on pronunciations and names, on no man's land, on reading orders, on anything you want, I invite and encourage you to reach out. You can find me several different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, 90sXmen on Facebook, Ace Comics on the ghost town we used to call Twitter. But with all that said, I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing a little bit of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight. Starting over after it breaks. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You've had to turn that page. When push it comes to shove, we do not fall out of